Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
All right, today I am joined by Alex Sakiris, who is a lot of things. He has many hats. So he is an entrepreneur, and he is an author of two books, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, and the book Why Evil Matters, How Science and Religion Fumbled a Big One. He's also the host of the show Skeptico, which I have been on. And a lot of people that are either friends of the show or maybe familiar to my listeners have been on Skeptico, such as Phil Fairbanks, Steven Snyder, the Subliminal Jihad Boys, Jason Horsley, William Ramsey, and Christopher Knowles. Additionally, just looking through, oh man, you've had such illustrious guests, like some pretty famous people. Sean Stone, Gary Lockman, Mitch Horowitz, some pretty big UFO people too, like Whitley Strieber, Richard Dolan, Jacques Vallée. Is it Vallée? I always
hear Vallée, but
there we go. Let's see. Also, David Icke. Very interesting perspectives, right?
Right.
How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, I think that this is going to be really fun because tell us a little bit, like, so your show, like, it's sort of like trying to get beyond just like that vulgar and reductive materialism and trying to explore some of that additional stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, it even started more kind of basic than that. It was just me using a podcast as a cover story for trying to understand some of the fundamental, you know, big picture stuff. Who are we? Why are we here? That's really where I started. And then I kind of, you know, the spirituality led me to the conspiracy stuff. Really, that is just genuinely what happened.
Now, let me ask you this, because this has been the case for me. I have found that actually, at least for me, the podcast is almost an excuse to just get to sit down and talk with a lot of these people, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, it's such a good pretext to just, like, ask some of the questions that I really want to hear and, like, talk to subject matter experts, and that is so much fun.
And then tell me if you can relate to this too, because once I got into it, I really learned to or gained an appreciation for the research process. And I know that seems to me something that you're, you know, passionate about because you find it fulfilling. And I do too. So I like preparing for these interviews. I like reading people's material with a purpose, you know, because it's one thing to read it and go, it's another thing to read it and say, wow, I'm going to be talking to that person. Or, you know, even more kind of intense, like this interview, I'm going to be talking to this person and we have differences of opinion, fundamental, you know, worldview differences. And we agree upon some stuff and we don't agree on some stuff. And there's some tension there that I think just makes it interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And like through the, you know, combining of these two perspectives, sometimes you come to a really interesting new place for sure.
Yeah.
Almost dialectical, if you will.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
So let's see. So with your show though, it's really interesting because you talk to a lot of people that aren't really even on my radar, right? And you talk about some topics that I just haven't really looked at, like near-death experiences. I basically don't know anything about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had a little email exchange beforehand. And, I, you know, to me, that's the reason I kind of pushed for this interview was, you know, it's one thing when you talk to somebody and you get a feeling that they really don't get it in some fundamental way. You know, they're a fundamentalist, religious fundamentalist, political fundamentalist or something, you know. And that's kind of easier to dismiss. But for me, I really, really enjoyed but also appreciated the way you were kind of putting some stuff together, you know, some of this historical stuff, Nazi stuff, you know, just on a whole different perspective, the Zen Buddhism stuff and the Japanese imperialism, totally filled in so many blanks for me. So, you know, when we came across some stuff that we weren't syncing up on at all, then that's what was really curious to me. So to me, you know, back to the near-death experience is just the end result of starting to getting to the root question of all of this stuff of, you know, what do we care about Hitler? Well, what we care on some fundamental level is that evil? We always talk about it as if it's, that's evil, that's evil. What does evil mean? Is there something more to evil than a social construct? The way I always put it, you know, fundamentally, if you really think deeply about these things, it comes down to one question. Is there a moral imperative? Is there such a thing as good and bad? Or is that always, under every circumstance, a moral construct? That, I'm sorry, a social construct. You know, it's our agreement. It's like, at this time and in this place and in our culture, this is what's right and wrong. But there isn't any real right or wrong. That to me, man, when I can't bring people to that question, that's a source of, you know, that gets my juices flowing. Like, why can't you deal with that? Isn't that the question?
Yeah. And Lord knows we've been talking about that a long time. Like, it will, obviously, like, Immanuel Kant was thinking along those lines, but well into, like, the ancient Greeks, am I right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, every, you know, like, you know, you mentioned briefly that you were brought up Mormon. I was brought up in the Greek Orthodox Church. I'm not religious at all. I see religion as really, really, you know, social engineering and mind control primarily, not that it doesn't serve other purposes.
Well, see, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
So where does that take you then? I mean, that's a pretty big one, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue that a lot of organized religion hasn't basically been instrumentalized outrightly by the state. And that's been true for almost every state. And additionally, it's almost like it performs that for like entire cultures that, you know, transcend the different, you know, nation states, right? So like, why is it doing that? Like, that's a really good question, right?
What are some of your thoughts on that, again, from your personal experience? I mean, you know, well, the Mormon thing, is your family still Mormon, can I ask? Or you don't have to answer that, but I mean, I'm sure you still know a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure. I know a lot of people and much of my family. Yeah. And like, see, to me, the question, I mean, separate from the question of does evil exist, which is probably, you know, the primary question, separately too, it is an open question. Is, you know, organized religion, does it do more harm than good or more good than harm? And see, that's the question that I'm sort of like interested in also, right? Like, because we know that it does harm. Do you think, like, this isn't rhetorical, I'm asking, do you think it does good?
Yeah, definitely. You know, and it's you're right. It's a tough one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of like going down kind of a absolutist kind of line of reasoning, if you will. But at the end of the day, that's not how we live our lives. So, you know, as a way for people to create community, for a way, if you do believe that there's something more, you know, that there is something more than biological robot, meaningless universe kind of thing, then there's some functions that need to be served in community and love, compassion, all those things that, you know, religion can do a job of supporting. But I do think I only go there if we first acknowledge that it's also has this element of social engineering, and that it's interjected itself as an intermediary, as an unnecessary intermediary. You know, you're walking through the forest and the light comes through and you feel God in every cell of your body and you go, wow, this is great. And then you go home and they say, okay, now let us tell you what that means. It means what we said right here in this book, and it doesn't mean anything else. It becomes the intermediary for what is a genuine spiritual experience. And that, you know, like the state.
Mm-hmm. And they say, open up your wallet too.
They do. So, you know, back to, I guess I did want to kind of come back to one point. So when I looked at that question for myself, like the moral imperative question, I looked to science. I said, okay, does science, because science has some good qualities, you know? I mean, at least science tries or pretends to try to be unbiased. It tries to say, okay, we all have prejudices. We all have, you know, blind spots. I'm going to try and control for all those. So the scientific basis for that question in my mind is kind of a twist in logic if you have to go there to follow it. It's to say the dominant paradigm is that there can be no such thing as good and evil. There can be no such thing as the moral imperative because we've accounted for everything. Everything is right here. Everything is measurable in this space-time. There's nothing outside. So that's why we can so confidently tell you that there can't be anything more. Well, the science now has come back and said, well, that's just not true. That's been falsified. So consciousness, that little voice inside your head, does seem to be able to extend beyond your body and beyond time and space. And you can get there a couple ways. You can get there with parapsychology experiments, very, very repeatable, very, very convincing ones. But you can also get there with like near-death experience. So long, super way, long around the barn of saying, that's my interest in all that, is to say, hey, does that science hold up to scrutiny? Because if it does, then there's more. And if there's more, then I shouldn't tolerate anyone telling me that, you know, it's all a social construct. And, you know, here's how I should understand Hitler. And here's how I should understand, you know, the horrors of Japanese imperialism. Oh, it's just a social construct. It's just, you know, people getting together and doing things. It's like, I don't know, put an asterisk there.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the scientific findings? Well, I mean, you said in a word, but what has been some very convincing evidence for you that like parapsychology suggests that?
Well, this is a tricky one because it always throws everyone a little bit because you have to marry it with that first part of what the paradigm insists. You know, it's kind of almost like religious dogma. The scientific dogma of materialism, of neuroscience. So first of all, we're talking about consciousness. We're talking about the voice inside your head. Yeah. If you say hello without vocalizing those words, you just say it in your head, there's a part of you that hears it and says, yeah, why are you saying that? You know, there's a little voice that's always going on in there. And let's label that as consciousness. So then the next step is to understand that the dogma of neuroscience, of science, is that that voice is always, under every circumstance, an epiphenomenon of your brain. It is your brain. It can never be anything other than your brain. And if that dogma is ever falsified scientifically, then that paradigm is really shattered. That's the way, because that's the way science works, right? If you put something out like that, then, you know, it's one black swan proves that all swans aren't white.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the case here. If you ever show under any circumstances that consciousness can be more than an epiphenomenon of your brain, then it's falsified. So you asked a pretty direct question. Like, here's a really simple experiment that somebody can look up. So there's this guy, Dr. Dean Radin, and I just had him on Skeptico recently again. And he's kind of going down the transhumanism shit, but that's a whole other story. But before that, he has really done some of the most powerfully convincing parapsychology experiments in history. And he's a PhD, super qualified. He used to work at Bell Labs. You know, no one kind of questions his credentials. No one questions his methodology. He's replicated his work something like 50 times. He's had other people, 7 different laboratories around the world have replicated this particular finding, like the presentiment experiment. So what he did was really clever, because he took an experiment that was well understood. Everyone thought they understood it. And that was, you take a person, and they used to do this, college freshman, you sit them down in front of a computer screen, and then you show them an image randomly selected by the computer, and you measure their response to it. So you show them a pasture scene, you show them, you know, flowers, you show them all sorts of nice stuff. And then you show them, boom, you know, murder, you show them sex, you mix it up. And the ones that are, we would imagine, really kind of would provoke a response, they provoke a response. You know, you see it physiologically, however you want to measure that.
Mm-hmm.
Skin dilation, you know, finger, you know, whatever. So the Radin twist was to say, well, let's see what's happening before the image is selected.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of space-time, outside of when the computer actually does the random number generator to do it. And he found, again, I mean, this is a Six Sigma result for anyone who understands, you know, standard deviations in statistics. It is like off the charts significant, billions to one. He found a pattern of response before the image is even selected. So you're hooked up and you're responding before the image is selected in a very, very, very small way, but measurable way and statistically significant way. So the hangup I usually run into when I explain that, there people just go, ah, so, you know, that's space. It's like, no. Come back to the thing. Your dogma, your paradigm insisted, demanded that could not happen. You were hung up on the idea that consciousness, the voice inside your head, could only ever be inside your brain. And now we have something that is outside of that experiment. It's not in your brain. It's not in this clock, in this time frame that we've set up in the experiment.
Very interesting. Now, let me ask you this. Because I know that there's like a many other experiments, and there's a whole body of evidence. Like, you've interviewed a lot of people, so I'm sure you could pull a bunch of other examples. But like, that makes sense to me. The thing that it makes me think of, and I wanted to see what you had to say about that, is I have read various experiments. You know, a lot of people like, beyond the surface level MKUltra stuff, they were looking at extrasensory perception in a lot of these programs, right? And like I'm saying for the listeners. And so they were testing for this stuff. They were doing these experiments, probably stuff kind of like what Dean Radin has been doing, but they were doing it in like the 50s and 60s. Like, What do you make of that?
Oh, man.
That there's indications that they were studying it, and that research didn't ever seem to come out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is programmed to chill stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is right in your swing zone. And I think you've actually, like, when I first stumbled upon this, this was another one of those kind of paradigm shifters for me, moving more into feeling like I really needed to understand conspiracy at a deeper level if I was ever going to wrap my head around this. Because, so we don't just talk total inside baseball, mm-hmm. Your point is like super salient to this whole thing, which is, you're right, these guys at Stanford Research Institute, Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, who is now right in the middle of the UFO thing, by the way, you know, all this, it has military intelligence, you know, and all these other crazy connections like Scientology and all this other stuff. But leave that aside. He's a legitimate scientist, like a super good scientist. And him and Russell Targ are at Stanford Research Institute. And like you say, they've been tasked with, okay, see what's going on with this ESP stuff, you know? And, you know, it's kind of like, again, this is, again, in your swing zone, because I love the way you kind of handle stuff from kind of the full spectrum kind of thing, which you have to. So these guys are tasked with kind of the men that stare at goats problem. Like, if anyone's ever seen that movie. And the reason I say it's a problem is that if someone can, with their mind, stare at a goat and make their heart stop.
The goat's heart stop. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we would kind of concede that, yeah, we want somebody looking into that. You know, I'm not sure how I feel about intelligence services in general, but we should know something about that, because we don't know if there's some guy in some evil country, fill in the blank, Russia, China, you know, North Korea, whatever, who's sitting in a room and trying to make somebody in our country make their heart stop, right? We don't know if that's happening. So go find out if that's at all possible, right? So we can understand why they tasked those guys to do it. Mm-hmm. And related to that, we also heard that these guys could do other stuff. They could spy on us.
Remote viewing. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Remote viewing. They could sit somebody in a room and say, okay, go look at those nukes over in the U.S. and go look at them, see where they, you know, and they can do it. We'd have no way of defending against that. So I'm kind of playing, I'm legitimately playing. You got to understand that risk assessment kind of thing that intelligence does. But back to you, unraveling that all the way back to your point, Jimmy, there was no pretending on their part of this ridiculous materialism, epiphenomena of the brain, biological robot shit. They were way past that. They assumed that there was more before they even would do any of their shit, because you wouldn't even do that unless you assumed there was more, right?
It kind of makes me wonder, like, then why did they keep up with the vulgar and reductive materialism?
Exactly.
Right? Is this like pro wrestling? Is this like kayfabe, right? Is it? I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, I think so. It's the only explanation that makes sense. It's just more, control, you know. It's more, you know, do you really want people out there kind of thinking in this, do you really want the large public at large kind of thinking in that way, kind of this expanded consciousness? No. And if they do, send them over here to the church, to the temple, to the whatever, because they kind of have figured out how to control that. But we don't want them just kind of wildly exploring what that could mean.
Exactly. Very interesting. And like, Lord knows we only have a limited picture, but when you like, I say for the listeners, when you get into like books like the, you know, the big one, the remote viewing book, or like you look at the resumes of these guys, yes, there was always an element of some like stage magic, charlatan, con man stuff, but like most of the people involved were like real scientists, and they were researching this stuff many decades before, like certainly before a lot of the counterculture picked up on it, you know? Like, it's just remarkable.
Yeah. You know, you touch on something else that's kind of interesting too, is the whole stage magic fakery thing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, you start digging into that, and it's controlled opposition, it's operations, it's people with, again, intelligence connections. That whole thing was driven by that. It was driven by a guy named James Randi, you know, most people know. But most people don't know, you know, like the whole human compromise thing. He was a guy that was compromised.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, he had, as James Randi tells it, and anyone can find this online, that he had a problem when he was a closeted gay man, which, you know, he's now passed, but I mean, this is a long time ago where that was like a big, big deal.
Yeah.
And then he had a problem because some younger teenage boys were crank calling his house with sexually explicit prank calls. So the local police suggested that he start calling these boys back in order to stop me whenever this story sounds so ridiculous that you just want to kind of put. So it looks, if you really look into it, like a guy who was kind of a go-to guy to kind of cloud, you know, it's the disinformation, misinformation thing. You just have to make it muddy the waters a little bit. So that's something you would want. And in my opinion, something that they had with that kind of skeptical thing, which has kind of gone away when James Randi went away. You know, there's really no one else out there really.
For the listeners, what did he do?
He was famous for like going on Johnny Carson and debunking psychics and debunking Uri Geller, who is like a whole interesting, because Uri Geller is Mossad. That's pretty much outed now.
Pretty much, yeah.
And Uri Geller, right. So it's like, again, it's programmed to chill. You know, it's like if you don't do 8 hours on it, you don't have a chance. Like people go, you know, why are you doing 8 hours on that? And what I hear you saying without you saying it is, bro, I couldn't really even cover it in 8 hours, but I did the best I could, you know?
Yeah.
And same here, you know, the twists and turns, spy versus spy kind of stuff. But, you know, back to the, I'll just cap it off. Oh, and then Randi had the $1 million challenge. Like if anyone has this, I actually had Randi on the show and I actually challenged Randi to the $1 million challenge because I had interviewed this Cambridge biologist, Rupert Sheldrick, who's really a cool guy and did some amazing experiments. But that's kind of a side story. The point being that James Randi was kind of known for the $1 million challenge, but anyone who's scientifically minded, back to your point, I think where you're headed, like these experiments are really, really easy to do and control at one level. Like Stanford Research Institute, again, Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, they actually produced a video of the testing they did at Uri Geller. I mean, a high school student can do this testing. You know, you take, they had the old fashioned film canisters, there were the little tin things, you know, way back in the day. So they took them in the other room and they put like a quarter in one of them and they had 12 of them on a tray, you know. And then they brought the tray back in and they said, okay, point to the one that has a quarter in it. I mean, these are, this is a high school experiment in terms of the controls that you have to do, you know, or, you know, blindfold them. And you know, it's just, it's not a difficult thing to control for. So that's what makes it even more interesting when you step back and go, and Randi kind of debunked all this, huh? It's like,
No.
Now, let me ask you this, because this has been an ongoing fixation of mine and a lot of my followers. Okay, because both in popular culture and in like the literature, it seems that gifted children have some sort of, or certain types of gifted children at least, might have certain types of abilities or proclivities towards like ESP or something. And the theory is that, well, and it, there's a million movies of it, which kind of makes you wonder if it's real, right? Is the idea that the government would be looking at these gifted children and possibly doing experiments on them, right? Do you have, or I'm sure some of your guests, or I'm like, what's your perspective on that idea?
Man, I think that's super duper interesting. And so like, how far have you gone down some of those trails? I mean, have you gone down Epstein as a gifted child?
Yes, although I went pretty far down that road, and I still don't exactly know what to make of that. Mm-hmm. I know Whitley Strieber in particular comes to mind.
Right, absolutely. So I'll speak to Whitley. Whitley is probably one of the best known UFO abductees, someone who was abducted by UFOs, which, by the way, you know, this has now just been, so we've had the whole, and a lot of people, a lot of your listeners might know this or might not accept it or whatever, but we are in a post-disclosure world that is no longer the official position of the United States government that we're not being visited. It is the official position that we are being visited, and they continue to roll out stuff. And just last week, they kind of slipped out. We don't know. Let me interject. Because you and I, we're not totally sure what that means, what the agenda is. And it's certainly hard to understand that from a pre-disclosure, after disclosure, because the message is completely reversed, right? So before December 2017, New York Times front page story, tic-tac, you know, all that, the official position was, you know, no. And then the unofficial position was go to people who would speak up and say, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your family. I'm going to kill everyone you know if you talk about this. So there's this kind of flip that we just brushed over, but I'm bearing the lead because just this last week, they released all this information, all these documents and all these cases going way back that now are accepting of not just the UFO sightings, but of the contact experience, the alien contact, the lost pregnancies, all that stuff that you've heard about in these crazy, wacky documentaries. The United States government has just released all that and said, we've been looking into that. So, you know, that's kind of point one, as because the reason I bring it up with regard to Whitley Strieber is that Whitley has been maligned his whole life, made a joke of his whole life. And there were some people that were true believers. Oh, Whitney really was abducted by aliens. But since the official story was, no, that's never happened. Well, now they're admitting that they're not speaking specifically to Whitley, but now that they're saying it's real, that is our official position, Whitley's story looks very, very different now in terms of the credibility. He always had not only his account, but his wife had witnessed it. He had friends, many, many friends who had witnessed the strange experiences that he had with the others. But you asked, I'm super interested in this point, so I'm sorry if I'm going on about the other thing, because I want to get...
No worries.
Well, I want to get back to, I'm really interested in this thing about the child prodigy kind of thing, and as it relates to the call of God thing, Have you heard about?
Maybe. Is that like when people get like a telephone call?
Exactly.
Like the God phone thing for Jack Sarfati.
Exactly.
That's what he called it. Yeah, yeah.
So back to Whitley. We're going to leave some loose ends here, but that's okay. Whitley, when he was a young kid growing up in San Antonio, like in elementary school.
San Antonio. Yeah, go on.
Exactly. Exactly. His dad happened to work at the base. And uncle was in military intelligence. That just happened. You know, hey.
Probably unrelated.
Probably. Exactly. Exactly. They come knocking on his door and they say, oh, Mr. and Mrs. Strieber, your son is gifted. We can see it. And we really think he ought to come to the base on the weekend and start this special program that we have. So they go, really? Our son is gifted? We always suspected that, but it's good to hear it from the Air Force. So they send him there, and Whitley describes going in, and there's a bunch of little kids. Some of them are in cages. They would sometimes bring little animals, like little bunnies, right up in front of their face and then cut their throat, traumatize them. And as we kind of understand, you know, this, like you had Phil Fairbanks on your show, and yeah. I did too, and Phil was great. You know, I mean, this is where you got to get past this reductionist, materialist, biological robot thing. Because what they're trying to do is they're trying to get these kids, they're trying to induce dissociative identity disorder. I'm saying that. I don't know that for sure, but that's the, have you heard that?
Well, I'll step in here because like in multiple MKUltra sub-projects, like we know for a fact that they were studying the effects of trauma. So like for sure, like they were studying dissociative, different types of disassociation. So like, for sure they were studying that. Now, as to Whitley's story, like, yeah, that's an open question, but like, I don't immediately find that at all, like impossible, right?
And I agree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to try and connect the dots though, from that is something that a lot of people they kind of pull up on, because where do you connect those dots? And there's two other dots out there. Mm-hmm. One is the kind of UFO ET thing. That's one dot. And the other dot is the demonic dot, right? What is your kind of investigation kind of show? You know, like MK often the satanic and the satanic is the better. I'm not religious, so I don't even know what satanic means, but these negative entities in the extended realm, let's connect with them kind of thing. What do you know about that?
Well, I know they were looking into it, and I know enough about just basically black magic to know that that's like the overt purpose of it is to contact these things that are supposedly out there.
Right. And, you know, I think it's, I just think it's interesting kind of in a, again, slipping into the kind of program to chill perspective, and it's going to mirror what I was saying about the other thing. It's like, hey, we would expect to a certain extent our intelligence apparatus to at least, I don't know if we want them to experiment with it, but we would want them to at least contemplate that. Because the question always is, well, maybe the Russians have Satan on their side. You know what I mean? If you stumble across this extended consciousness realm and you stumble across this means of accessing it through dissociative identity disorder, you almost have to ask that next question. You know, it's almost your responsibility to ask that next question.
Yeah. And like, not to just tell Whitley's story, but like a bunch of Operation Paperclip Nazis were right there in San Antonio.
Exactly.
Right.
And you know, and then the other thing that Whitley told me, and I haven't heard anyplace else. So then he has like fragmented memories of this. Mm-hmm. And he's a super interesting guy to talk to, but it's also kind of difficult to talk to him because you really get the sense that he's someone who is genuinely struggling with trying to put all that stuff together.
Yeah.
And yeah. And he says, you know, when I came back, I want to know if it's real. And, you know, I tried to connect with other kids that I knew. And the one thing he says is chilling. He goes, I know the boy across the street. He was part of it. He never left his house after that. He died 52 years old in the house with his parents. He was crushed, you know. Mm. And he also tells stories about, here's another connection, like you were saying, you know, with the other, you just kind of hear this, being taken down to Mexico.
Oh, man. When I read that from Whitley's account that I read, and I was just like freaking out about that.
Right. Tell us why.
Well, just because that's where the finders were supposed to be going.
Exactly. Right. Right? And remind people about the finders.
Well, many of my listeners probably do know, but like the finders cult, of course, was a cult that was found trafficking children that the CIA intervened and shut down the investigation of. Like officially, they shut down the investigation.
Yeah.
That's the short version of it. And it's just like, what?
And then again, bringing that up to, you know, the present is when they looked into it, it gets really kind of freaky Hall of Mirrors kind of thing. Like, yeah, it's these children and this cult and mind control, but then it's also pornography, child pornography. It's human compromise in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. It's, which is, you know, the Jeffrey Epstein thing. And it's like, it's none of those things, but it's all of those things. It's like, you know, where do you go?
Yeah, no, for sure. Now, Let me ask you this, because I'm still in the realm of speculation, but I know that you do talk to a lot more people and you're just more interested in science for the most part. I have heard speculation that Epstein was, that like there were other aspects to Epstein that aren't publicly like made public. Obviously not just like the blackmail angle, but like the idea that he was procuring just like 16-year-old girls, like for the rich and powerful, that's not exactly hard to get. You know what I'm saying? Like you can, a lot of different networks could probably provide that. Then there's the idea that it's treated like this bizarre interest of Epstein's, that he was interested in freezing his genitalia and like breeding a whole bunch of little Jeffrey Epstein's, and like he was interested in cryogenics and like, you know, mass breeding programs. So like, what do you make of that like transhuman angle to Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, I think the transhumanism thing is interesting, just kind of from an occult, from a spiritual angle, which where it's where all this stuff kind of gets. It's like at some point you gotta almost put on a completely different hat, you know, and separate yourself from that. Say, okay, everyone's grabbing at this spiritual question, you know, and look at where we've gone in this conversation. And it's interesting because you hit on it when you dragged us into the MK Ultra stuff.
I'm always doing that.
Well, it was a great move. It was a perfect move because if folks remember what that propelled us into is to say two things. One is to say the whole idea of how you understand science is an op, is a social engineering, is a fucking control thing. And the reason we know that, as you pointed out, is because in the 1950s and 60s with MKUltra, they said, well, shit, we know it's more than that. So let's start looking at, you know, what you can do with your mind and remote viewing and demons and time space. Let's look at all that shit. But let's tell academia to kind of keep that whole line, keep a tight lid on that, you know, just keep going down that same shit neuroscience. You're just keep them saying that while we go look at the real stuff, you know. That's major, major conspiratorial social engineering stuff. And so there's two paths to that other thing. You know, one is to say, okay, you know, are they getting us, you know, defend ourselves? And then the other thing that's always intertwined with that is like, yeah, and by the way, if we could weaponize that, that'd be really cool too, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But the other thing that opens up is this back to this moral imperative. Hey, while we're doing this, do we have to worry about God? Do we have to worry about whether this is right or wrong?
Mm.
No. Just keep doing what we're doing and we'll worry about that later. Well, at some point, you do have to even philosophically kind of say, well, how are we supposed to decide, you know, now that we know there's all this vast power out there, how are we supposed to decide how we carve that up? Because don't you think that is the fundamental question to transhumanism, is the moral imperative?
I really like the linking transhumanism to the moral imperative question, because like, I think everyone I talk to, even normies, so to speak, look at a lot of the transhumanism stuff and go, that literally looks evil. That looks satanic. This looks like a really bad direction society is headed in. And very few people that I ever talk to, maybe because I'm not rich enough or something, I don't know, but like, I never meet anyone who says, yes, I want to go down that road. That looks like not a dystopia.
Exactly. No, I mean, which just is chilling in a way, because you step back and go, mm-hmm. Wait a minute, what is driving the people who are driving? If no one's on board, who's driving the train?
Yeah, why does everything keep heading towards transhumanism if most people don't seem to want that?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know.
Like, why can't we just use any of these new technologies to just make society a fairer and more equitable place? I don't know.
And you know, again, if you just keep coming back to the kind of moral imperative thing, it kind of becomes a solve for a lot of the problems, because there's no absolutes, you know, with the moral imperative kind of thing. There is good and bad. You can just look inside yourself and know what's the right thing and the wrong thing to do. Well, of course, that doesn't always work. You know, you're going to make mistakes, but you just keep coming back and go, okay, but I have to, again, try and, you know, golden rule, you know, do unto others. And I just keep applying that, and I make some mistakes, but I just keep coming back. And then, as you said, we have an intuitive sense that there's some people who are operating under a whole different principle of like, they're never coming back to that again and again. They're just going, no, I kind of have a different agenda here.
Yeah. Very interesting.
What do you think of the, I mean, I guess you kind of stated it, but with the transhumanist agenda. But to what extent, let me ask you this, to what extent do you think that is kind of cover for something deeper, darker, you know? Because there's a logical part of the transhumanism kind of thing. You know, there's a certain logic to it, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Like, when I was younger, I read, was it Ray Kurzweil?
Yeah.
One of the big transhumanism guys. And like, I thought it was interesting. I was like, oh, damn, that's crazy if that happens. But like, when we get a lot more into like the Neuralink stuff, all of that, like, I don't know. It just seems really, really bad.
Well, I guess maybe the broader question is, in general, how do we peel away the cover stories? You know, because that's what we're always doing, it seems like, you know, that's what you're always doing. And in the process, it's trickier than, right? I mean, that's a tricky proposition, because there's some truths there too, you know, I mean, it's hard to know, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's one thing that I really like about largely the work of other people that have been looking at the real history of Silicon Valley. You know, we touched on that when I was on your show, where it's just like, a lot of the stories we hear about Silicon Valley are just patently like made up. And it's not to say that they're completely false, but like, you know, a lot of this technology was discovered earlier than they said. And then they like found people to head companies to release the technology. And I'm not talking about like really far out stuff. Like I'm saying like 10 or 20 years, you know, they discovered it 10 or 20 years, not like 100 years ago or anything super crazy, but like, it just seems like a lot of like, well, you know, like with the remote viewing, you know, project, out of that project, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the computer mouse and like a lot of satellite technology came out of research associated with that. It's just like crazy.
And again, it's tricky, right? Because you really have to, it's a mixture, I think, you know, it's a mixture of different things. So it's like, point well taken. And we've seen that over and over again, where we see, you can pretty easily kind of trace some of this technology, particularly in defense, you know, so they come out with the stealth thing and then they, oh, okay, well, we've announced it. You know, now it's real.
Yeah.
And then you go, well, shit, if you're announcing it now, then we had, you know, documents that were secretly released 20 years ago that said it was out. And you go, and there's a silence on the other end of the, they go, yeah, well, we did have it 20 years ago. Well, then you go do the math. You go, well, shit, if you had it up in the air 20 years ago, then when did you start building it?
Yeah.
And there's another silence on the end. And then you get an aerospace engineer and you go, okay, if they flew that thing 20 years before they announced it, how long before that did they start building it? Did they start designing it? Did they have the technology for it? And then you, it's exactly to your point, Jimmy. Now you're suddenly, you're like 40 years.
Yeah.
So then you take that and you start applying that to some different things. But then the kicker though, or the, you know, the, like I was saying, you know, and you've run across too, that doesn't mean that there is some genius that kind of figures stuff out along the way that kind of jumps in there and kind of, you know, doesn't follow the DARPA, the DARPA path or whatever, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. No, it's funny because like me and a buddy, we were doing an episode and we were talking about Mothman. Right. So we were reading, you know, Keel and all those firsthand accounts of all that stuff. And like, I tell you, there's a account of a guy who saw what sounds exactly like a drone that you could just buy today and just go fly at the park. And it sounds a whole lot like the guy was just like doing a radio operated drone. But like, that was back in what, like the 60s, I think. Like crazy, crazy stuff. And that's like relatively simple technology. It's super advanced for back then, of course, but like, who knows what's going on? It's crazy.
Yeah. And it's the thing that I always kind of latch onto is it's kind of now been revealed. It's no longer hidden in that way, is that they've kind of acknowledged it. And I'm always leery when people don't make the reset, you know, like I'm just saying, you know, okay, now that, therefore this, then that, you know, like if we know this, now we can only assume that the undisclosed secret stealth stuff that we saw 20 years ago, that was legit, right? I mean, you can't deny that anymore because you've admitted it here, to give that simple example again.
But you see, they were lying then, but there's no reason to think they're lying now.
Oh, God. Yeah. which is, you know, I know you're not into the UFO thing, but like one of the most interesting
I'll let you go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was saying, like, I definitely take your point that, like, there is a phenomenon. And then additionally, there's definitely like government involvement and all that disinfo and stuff. But anyway, sorry, what was your...
Oh, that's perfectly okay, because it kind of picks up on the last interview we had, and the whole Mirage Man, Richard Doty thing came up. Mm-hmm. And to me, wow, this is like, I'm begging you, Jibby. I'm begging you, begging you. I will help fund, sponsor. I'll be the official sponsor of a Program to Chill deep dive into this, because it's right up your alley, and it's not directly UFO, but it's the Paul Benowitz thing. So there's this guy, his name is Paul Benowitz, and he lives right next to Kirkland Air Force Base. So this is out in Albuquerque. And if anyone's been to Albuquerque, it's Wild Wild West kind of stuff, you know? So nowhere else in the country would they just start building houses right next to an Air Force Base. But whatever. That's just happens to be where he lives. And he's just like a regular guy. He's like a small business owner. I think it was like
wasn't he like an engineer or something too? Or like he had like some sort of background like that.
Yeah, I think it was like an electrician or something like that, you know, but with his own little, you know, kind of company and stuff. So he starts getting interested in UFOs and we'll just kind of leave it at that. And then he gets so interested that he sets up this frickin' super advanced like observatory on his roof, which again, a lot of people like Mirage Men, I'll give you the kind of end story. Mirage Men is a cover story on top of a cover story. Mm-hmm. It is this kind of, again, Program to Chill, kind of misinformation to cover and then to float in some disinformation. Paul Benowitz is up on his roof, and now he's got this super good camera equipment, and he starts observing stuff on Kirkland Air Force Base. And in January of 1980, he calls over to the base as this kind of genuinely kind of proud American, you know, kind of like, hey, man, I'm worried. Do you guys know these lights are out there? And who answers his call? Well, of course, an intelligence officer, not an engineer, not a researcher, not an aerospace guy. Who do we send out there? An intelligence officer named Richard Doty. Hmm. And here's the other interesting part, and then I'll leave it at that because it's too long of a story. But Mirage Men, this is kind of the lead hook for people. If you watch Mirage Men, it's a fake. And the reason you know it's a fake is because Paul Benowitz contacted him in January, and there's even documentation of that. And they don't acknowledge publicly, like in Mirage Men or anyplace else, that he contacted him until April, May, when they had already gotten inside his head and done all this, used him to kind of spread this disinformation and to do all this crazy stuff, and the aliens like strawberry ice cream, which Doty later says behind cloak of a cover, you know, all this kind of crazy, crazy stuff that goes on. But interesting. And the cover story also, the reason it relates, and I know we're way too deep into inside baseball here for people to probably get. The other cover story was that, oh, it's not UFOs. Gosh dang it. Doty had to lie, had to do criminal misconduct. I mean, he should be in jail. I interviewed Colonel John Alexander, who I don't know how much we trust, but he's like, hey, if anything that Doty is saying is true, he should be in Leavenworth. He should be in jail. You can't do that. You can't go, you know, break into the guy's house, you know, do these mind games on him, try and convince him he's crazy. You can't do that to an American citizen who isn't under any charges. And their cover for why they did that turned into, oh, well, we had to hide the stealth bomber and some other stuff that we had over there. Not that there were UFOs, because again, it's this before disclosure, after disclosure. At that time, 1980, there were no UFOs. There are now because we've disclosed it, but back then there wasn't. So the only thing we could be covering up would be, oh, stealth bomber and other secret shit, so the Russians don't get it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, we can't even get a straight answer on UFOs, honestly. What makes us think that we'll get a straight answer on the disinformation campaigns and infiltration of UFO communities, right? Like, that'll never come out.
And the other thing, I guess, that I'm always surprised that people don't connect is, hey, that's just the laboratory for everything else, for, you know, public health, for politics, or, I mean, do we think it somehow operates differently, you know, for this tiny little UFO community than it does for, you know, pick your other slice of the cultural pie?
No, for sure. Like, the UFO community, I think, is a really good case study when you look at, say, the militia movement of the 80s, or the tinfoil left, if you will, or as other fringe communities, like seeing what the government did to handle them and then extrapolating on what could be happening now, for sure.
Exactly. And also, you know, include in that the example I always like to throw in there is like the women's movement, Gloria Steinem.
Yeah.
Because it's so dramatic. I mean, she outs herself as CIA going in, you know, not flipped, but CIA going in. So,
and then everything she ever did has a very different, like, color to it. Not to discredit everything or, you know, whatever, but like every interaction with every other feminist leader comes across very differently. Like, the whole story really shifts when you realize that this lady was a CIA operative. It's crazy.
Totally. Totally. And maybe expound on that shift, because again, it's the subtleties of it. It doesn't mean that some of those relationships aren't real in some way, but we have to kind of re-examine them. If, you know, where is the realness?
Exactly. And like, I don't know, I just find it like endlessly interesting. Like, I really like just excavating and doing the work of like figuring out, okay, this person was essentially an infiltrator. How did that color the whole story? That's like my favorite thing to do. So like, for sure. Very interesting. Well, I mean, what do you think? I think we had a really good conversation. Are there any other topics you'd like to talk about?
No. I'm glad that we kept bringing it back to where we intersect, you know, on this thing, because, you know, for even just our personal growth and development, which we kind of both started out saying that essentially that's why we do this thing. We do need different perspectives in a different way than most people talk about different perspectives. You know, people usually talk about different perspectives as, oh, you know, well, liberal versus a conservative. And it's like, no, I'm not as interested in that. I'm like interested in different perspectives on truth finding, you know, and there are a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different ways to go about it. And that's why I was so drawn to your show, is like, wow, here's a guy who's going about figuring out this truth from another way. Isn't that cool? And so, yeah, that's why I think it's cool to have, you know, connected in this way.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate your show because I just like the format of like, you know, a good interviewer, and like, you've had some of the craziest, in a good way, like crazy guests, like really good stuff. So like, people should definitely check out Skeptico. Like, there's something for everybody in the catalog, I would say, at a minimum.
Well, thanks. It'll definitely piss you off for sure, but that's okay. That's part of the process, you know?
No, for sure. Like, both by guest and by topic, like, there's something for everybody. But where can people find your books and your show?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, you did a super job. It's Skeptico. They'll find it, you know, man, it's
there. I'll link it. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And it's not. Yeah.
All right. Did you have any other or any closing thoughts or anything you'd like to say?
No, man. Thanks again, Jimmy. Appreciate it. I'll be listening.
Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world every day. Satan is real, working with power. He can tempt you and lead you astray.
I attended service at a little church in the country not long ago. A prayer was led by an old country preacher who then raised his hands as everyone stood and sang, "My God is real." A warm breeze through the open windows brought in the smell of new-mown hay in a nearby field, and the singing of birds could be heard in the moment of silence as the preacher opened his Bible to read. And then a little old man stood up, bent with age, his hair thin and white, and said, "Preacher, tell them that Satan is real too. You can hear him in songs that give praise to idols and sinful things of this world. You can see him in the destruction of homes torn apart. I know that Satan is real, for once I had a happy home. I was loved and respected by my family. I was looked upon as a leader in my community. And then Satan came into my life. I grew selfish and unneighborly. My friends turned against me, and finally my home was broken apart. My children took their paths into a world of sin. Yes, preacher, it's sweet to know that God is real, and to know that in him all things are possible. And we know that heaven is a real place where joys shall never end. But sinner friend, if you're here today, Satan is real too. And hell is a real place, a place of everlasting punishment. Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world. Can tempt you.